When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to the latest in a series of episodes we're recording to celebrate the 50th anniversary of BMW's legendary M Performance Division. I'm Autocar's news editor, Felix Page. Joining me today is editor-at-large Matt Pryor.
Hello, mate.
How are you?
Yeah, good. Yeah, really well. Thank you. Yeah.
Fantastic. And we're very pleased to welcome today's guest, Dan Norris. He's the managing director of Munich Legends, the West Sussex BMW specialist that, I think it's fair to say, it's become a bit of an institution in enthusiast circles. So, morning, Dan. How are you?
Morning. I'm good. Thanks. How are you guys?
Yeah, pretty well.
Yeah, pretty well.
I think institution rings a little bit too true some days, but yeah.
You're joining us from France, which looks nicer than here.
I am. Well, yeah, it's a nice day today. Yeah, I'm very lucky to be here today.
Yeah, beautifully backlit on the screen, isn't it? It's just like a little halo of sunshine around it.
Yeah, it feels just like southwest London.
If it was the other side, it'd be pots and pans. So, you know, it's better than it's the sea.
We'll take it.
Well, the reason we wanted to talk to you, Dan, is because BMW enthusiasts in the UK and internationally sort of see Munich Legends as this halo for the brand, really, outside of the company itself. But I learned while looking into the business, it's actually older than M, isn't it?
Well, technically, yes, it is, I suppose, yeah. I think Munich Legends, the premises is called the Ashdown Garage, and that premises dates back as a BMW outlet to, I think, 68. So pre-BMW UK, back when it was all bits of paper and a very odd mark. So, in a sense, we do kind of predate it.
I suppose back then, BMW in the UK must have been a bit of a revolution. I can't imagine any other brand that was on sale back then that would have compared.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't
it? Yeah. So what was on sale back then, 1967, 1968?
Oh, don't.
2007 well, and everything
you
like
know,
that.
The funny thing is that this all started very badly for BMW. And if you think about it, if you take yourself back to the late 60s, I remember my granddad, when I was a nipper in the 70s, would not buy a German car, wouldn't entertain it, wouldn't buy Japanese, wouldn't buy German. He still had that very recent, you know, for them, pretty recent memory of the war. And on top of that, the stuff that BMW were producing looked more like Eastern European, you know, Eastern Bloc cars, very boxy, very square, not very pretty. And suddenly they're doing things like producing a 3-litre CSL. So they're suddenly, you know, they're asking thousands of pounds, the same price as a semi-detached house in Woking, for a car that nobody really understands. Nobody realises there's no pedigree there. It's German. There's no dealer network. It's either very bold or very stupid, but somehow they managed to pull it together.
Well, it's got to be partly because of cars like that. You know, that was a massive brand shaper, I guess, a brand builder. And they're still doing it today to an extent, aren't they?
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so. And what's your background, Dan? How did Munich Legends come about as it is today?
So I was a client for 15 years. I ran a telecoms company just literally up the end of the Mile Strait. And I spent way too much time at Munich Legends, as you can probably imagine, on the basis that they were looking after our company cars. So it started off with me looking for a solution for salespeople as the sort of sales manager, and saying, well, look, rather than buying them leased cars, Vauxhalls and rubbish that they don't really want, I'll buy secondhand BMWs, and that way I'll attract more, you know, higher quality salespeople. And it worked. And then, of course, you get caught up with it all, and suddenly it takes over, and I'm there all the time. And there was the guys that ran the business at the time had a bit of a disagreement. Basically, the directors fell out, and I just sold a division of the telecoms company that I was running, and done a good deal out of it. And so I was out to dinner one night with the remaining director, and sort of giving him probably unwanted advice about how he should run his business. And he just turned around and said, well, if you're so clever, then why don't you buy it off me? So I did. it was one of the bravest or stupidest things I've ever done, because I had no knowledge of running a garage. And, you know, like a lot of people, I thought I knew about cars, but you don't really know until you're on the other side of the fence, really.
And is that risk, isn't it? If you suddenly start doing what is effectively your hobby for a living, it can spot. I know people who've worked for, with their passion, and they've suddenly gone, oh God, this completely ruined my enthusiasm for what I love doing. But that's clearly not the case for you.
It's the challenge actually has been trying to focus on making money actually alongside something that you love, because. You know, I go to work nearly every day planning to run it like a proper grown-up businessman should. And then someone turns up in a really nice car, and I just say, oh, look, there's a really nice car, and off I go. And we're all a bit like it, you know, because we are there for the cars. You know, we're there for the cars and the people. And it's a very distracting environment. You know, trying to get there and work through your day's worth of, that's my list of things to deal with today, is a constant challenge. And so for years...
Stock list.
Well, for years, just trying to remember that we're there to make a profit, and if we don't make a profit, we won't be there. You know, that's the most difficult part about running any enthusiast business, I think.
Just looking at your stock list, it's sort of quite easy to see how you could be distracted, I think. But what is it about BMW that first attracted you to Munich Legends and sustained your customer base? What do people love about BMW, do you think?
I think it is the cheesy answer that it is the ultimate driving machine. Honestly, I think once you've driven the right BMW, obviously they've dropped a few clangers, but by and large, they are geared around people who really know what they want from a car, and people who understand the basics of sort of engineering and traction and the traditional layout of rear wheel drive, powerful engine up the front, well balanced chassis. We sort of repeat these things over and over again. But of course, what that gives you is a car that when you sit in it, you can feel all the corners of it. You feel like you know what it's going to do. It talks to you. And I think any enthusiast is going to, whether they can actually quantify that or they can consciously, rationally lay out that's why they like it. A lot of people, I think, just drive it and think, I get it. You know, as soon as you jump into an Audi or a Merc, I love Mercedes, but the engineering's just not there. And, you know, that's what pulled me. I had a 500 SEC and it broke. And this is when I was running my telecoms company. And the local hire company had a 525, E34, 525. And on paper, you know, they're not a patch on each other. I mean, the 500 SEC was top, you know, nearly top of the range for Mercedes. And I remember jumping into that E34 and just thinking, well, you know, why is this car so much nicer to drive than something that's probably in the showroom four times the price? And it started there and it never stopped.
And when you, because you will be in and out of BMWs of all ages, when you get in a modern one and you then may jump out into an old one and something halfway in between, do you still think there's that, I hate this phrase, DNA, but do you get that sense that there is the same thread running through them still now?
Yeah, I do actually. Yeah, I do. Thankfully, because I need to feel that there's still, I still think they get it. And I think, I've just bought an M6 Grand Coupe, the competition pack.
Oh yeah.
And you know, you look at what an absurd car that is, and think that's never going to drive like a sports car. It's never going to drive like a BMW should. And somehow they've pulled it off. And even jumping into the G90, the four wheel drive, you know, the current M5, it's four wheel drive. It's automatic. You know, I thought I was going to hate it, but if you've driven one, you'll know that you can't hate that car.
It's, no,
they have still got it.
Yeah. And that M6 Grand Coupe, that's a real, a bit of a sort of slightly underrated gem, isn't it? That I got in one and like you thought, oh, this is, you know, what's this going to be like? And it's really good. Suddenly go, oh, this feels like a proper M car. This is great.
It's got that folding round you thing where you forget that you've got this huge thing at the back of you. You know, you feel like you could be in an M2. It's that's the magic of it, I think, that you just become at one with the steering wheel and you're in your little cockpit and off you go, you know, and you forget that you've got this hulking great big, you know, Grand Coupe around you. It's phenomenal, really.
Well, that's a really interesting point because it might be a bit of a controversial topic, really, but fast SUVs make M a lot of money these days, X3 and X5M. There aren't any on your forecourt. Do you think they can still do the whole M thing? Do you value them as performance cars?
No. I think you just can't. You can't win over physics. And I do remember when they launched the X5M, they did a drive it day at Goodwood, and Tiffany Dell and all that lot were there doing, you know, power laps and stuff. And yes, you can go barreling into a corner in an X6M and it feels great until you try and steer 2.5 tons of weight with a high center of gravity round a bend. You know, it just is still an SUV and it still makes you want to be sick. So I think it's worth them having a go, but and there's a place for SUVs in this world, I guess. But no, I do think I worry too much about them cheapening the brand. And of course they stick an M badge on pretty well everything nowadays. But hey, you know, if it makes a slight improvement on a family monster, then fine. It doesn't do any harm. It doesn't interfere with what we do. And of course, a lot of our clients will have a practical car and something naughty on, you know, to drive around at the weekends. So you've got to look after them all.
Well, that's interesting. I was speaking to Frank Van Meel the other day, CEO of M, and he tells me that there are still a lot of M customers who track their cars, who are very keen on shaving seconds off lap times, probably not in the X5 M. But do you have a lot of customers who come to you and say, you know, I use this Brands Hatch on Saturdays and that's all I do with it?
The SUVs?
No, the normal M cars.
Yeah, we do. I mean, we see everybody across the spectrum, really. And we've still got a lot of clients that know more about their cars, really, than we do. And that's the bit that I think keeps us all, you know, trying, if you like, because for a lot of our clients, their cars are the most important thing in their lives next to their family. The level of enthusiasm that people still have for their cars and the stuff they want to do to them, it still, you know, it still impresses me every day. And particularly things like M3 CSLs, I mean, they're an interesting car because they've been through that phase of being everybody's favorite weekend weapon. And then, of course, they get to a certain price and people think, well, I can't really keep smashing it around the tracks at the weekend. So they try and rehabilitate them and sell them. But I think there's still a huge demand, especially as the roads get harder and harder. I mean, I know it's a cheesy thing to say, but because I spend a bit of time in France, I obviously come back to Munich very regularly. But being away, you come back to England, and every time I come back, I think these roads are now, they're undrivable. So I think that's why people like to go to tracks, because basically you can't do what you used to be able to do on the A roads.
And have you noticed over the years that customers come to you and are using their cars in different ways today than they used to? I mean, I'm thinking of the car culture you get these days, where I know you do that, you know, you do car and coffee evenings and things like that. You know, is there a sense that people are using fun cars differently to how they might have done 20 years ago?
I think people spend a lot more money on their cars than they used to. And I think so we have this, the thing you're talking about is Legends in the Fall, which is this evening we do every September. And this year, because it's the first time since we've done COVID, I didn't know, is anybody going to come back? Has everybody forgotten about us? You know, and of course, it's the opposite. But normally we say to people, get there for about 6:30. But people were arriving in dozens, you know, from about 5 o'clock. And they're turning up in fantastic tune machines, you know, the classic cars that they've converted into track day weapons and kitted them out. There's just everything from, you know, an M5 CS right the way back to, you know, a caged out 2002. And this is what I'm saying. You know, they're clearly much more important. They're growing and growing in stature in people's lives. And they're spending more and more money on, you know, instead of going out and saving up to buy a house, they're spending it on a fancy car. And, you know, car culture is stronger, I think, than it's ever been. And it's just growing and growing and growing all the time.
Are you a purist when it comes to owning a classic car? Do you like everything to be original, or are you as excited about the caged out 2002 as the mint factory paint 3-litre CSL?
I have to be very careful about how I answer these type of questions. Everybody's got, you know, it's a very personal thing. And I have to emphasise that I don't judge anybody, because we get people that, you know, to me, might not have my taste. It might be appalling taste, but it's still their taste and it's what they want to do with their car. And I'm not directly answering the question yet, but there's sometimes when I get a really, really low mileage car, you know, you get an E30 M3 that's got 5,000 miles or something on it, and you think, well, it's an absolute gem, and you publish it on Instagram, 50% of the people go, what a waste, you know, how can that, it's criminal that the person never uses the car. They'll comment if he keeps it in a garage, in a dehumidified garage, and keeps it pristine and factory original. But then somebody's always got an opinion if you slam it and light it up underneath and, you know, and use it to do donuts in car parks. Personally, the joy of owning a true classic is often in the fact that, you know, being nerdy about it and taking it back to exact original spec. But at the same time, you know, I don't think there are any rules. I think you know, if you find a car that's got no service history, someone's completely modified it, and you still look at it and think, yeah, I don't mind giving 20 grand for that, just have a laugh in it. Mm. There's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on the car.
Yeah. And it's just, it strikes me that with car coverage, there's not enough of us to go round to start having divisions. Do you know what I mean? I just say, look, you know, we're all spending money on cars, and if people aren't spending money on boats and houses and anything else, you know, that's good. That's fine with me. Have what you like. Slam it, lift it, whatever you want to do. I'm very happy with that. Yeah.
I remember at Gaydon, I don't know if you know the BMW Car Club. They do a yearly. It's quite a nice meet. They do it up at the ground, the proving ground up at Gaydon. And I remember last time I went there, that obviously you've got the older school car club types who bring along their Z3M coupes and they line them all up and they're all factory perfect and original, and that's great. And then on the other side of the field, you've got these guys, you know, there's a lot of guys, you know, sort of West London posse who have spent thousands of pounds and weeks and weeks and weeks at a time kitting out the boot with these amazing stereo systems. And you'll have these guys over here tutting because when they pull away, you know, they're turning up the tunes and everything else. I can look at both those schools. I can look at the guys that have got all this amazing kit in the boot and just, you know, with absolute wonder, because they've devoted their lives to it. And it's just the same to me as whether these guys have devoted their lives to keeping their cars original or whether they've devoted it to customising it. It's, you know, as you say, we're all in the same club.
We're going through a bit of a strange period for that sort of thing because, you know, secondhand car prices being what they are, there must be less appetite for modifying your car. And presumably your classic E30s and your E39 M5s, they're presumably soaring in value at the moment. So what is the appetite for them like at the moment?
I think I see the classic cars or the modern classics, I think you've got to see the public as a sort of a pyramid. And as a car increases in value, it moves it up towards the apex of the pyramid. And of course, the pyramid's thinner at the top. There's less people with that money. So I think the only thing that's a shame about the rising values, I mean, rising values are really good for classic cars because it means people can spend money keeping them fresh and keeping them up to date, and they don't feel like they're wasting the money because it stays invested in the car. But the downside of it is it's putting a whole strata, another, every time there's it goes up a chunk, it's a whole strata of people that can no longer afford those cars. And when you look at what people, you know, what people can afford and what they can buy into in the way of modern classics, of course, it's getting thinner and thinner on the ground, and you're always looking for the next big thing. But E39 M5s are a good example of that. You know, I can see them within a couple of years of being out of reach of, I say, normal people. I don't know what a normal person is, but you know what I mean. It's less fun if you're having to remortgage your house to buy it.
Yeah, there is that thought, isn't it? The more you spend on something, somehow the bigger the risk you are every time you use it. You know, some people own very exotic supercars and then just go, I can't use it anymore. The risk of, you know, the risk of taking it on a circuit is just too great, or the risk of doing that. You know, the less you spend on something, the more you can thrash the living daylights out of it. And it's, you know, it doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah. I suppose the problem with old BMWs is there's not much in the way of sort of undiscovered gems, is it?
That is interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that is interesting. Is there, yeah. Go on. So what are you thinking about now as the next potential thing in the BMW world?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, I mean, I suppose in the thing that strikes me as a car that people, that I think is growing in stature but still not growing in price, is the E24, the standard E24 635s.
Okay.
You know, they tick a lot of boxes for what people are looking for, I think, in a modern classic, and they're still relatively easy to run. You can still get the bits, and they're quite accessible for a lot of people. They're not super fast, but you know, they're still fast enough to have a bit of fun. There's 3.5 liter, you know, they're still a reasonably sexy car. But of course, they've quad headlights and kidney grille, classic look, shark nose coupe, you know. And I think they're a little bit overlooked because they sort of had a bit of a stuffier image, but I'm noticing that they're starting to appear in more and more videos. You know, young people's music, you know, they're starting to sort of, there's a new generation of people. I see it with E30s, funnily enough, as well, standard E30s. I find it really encouraging that because you worry that car culture is going to die. And as kids grow up now, being told that cars are evil and, you know, encouraged to get on electric bikes and God knows what, you know, I still think it's good that there are people out there that see the sort of charm in these sort of classics. And so I think, yeah, something like I would tip an E24 635 as being a pretty cool, pretty easily accessible modern classic, really.
Yeah.
I'd like to say E12 M535i has always been one that I think people missed. But there's so few of them around that the chance of you finding one to pick up are pretty slim.
Yeah. Do you actively seek things like that? You know, it's sort of not barn finds necessarily, but you know, do you always have people out on the lookout for for cars squirreled away somewhere that, you know, that need a bit of titillation and bring back to life?
Yeah, I mean, it's a holy grail, isn't it? Everybody wants to find that barn find that's just got that perfect layer of dust, and underneath the dust is a perfect
no rust and everything. Yeah,
they're my favourite one. I love the thing that I still get the biggest kick out of is a wreck turning up and looking at it and thinking, brilliant, that looks like a wreck, but I can see through that and I can see a beautiful car in there. And it's always the most exciting when you go and give it to the valeting team and say, right, you know, go and just make that as amazing as you can make it look. And it comes back to you, you know, a week later and it's gleaming. I still think, I went out looking for an E12 M535i because I wanted one for myself. I still want one. I'll still buy one if I find one. And, you know, the problem is that I've still got to have one eye on it being a reasonable investment. I don't need to make money on it if I'm going to keep it for myself, but you know, I like to think that I'm not going to completely have my pants pulled down. And unfortunately every single one that I looked at was beyond what I would call economical repair.
Okay.
Because you want some relativity between what the car's worth and what you spend on it, really. If for no other reason than to justify it to your wife or to your friends or whatever, you know.
When it comes to, and speaking about value for money, when it comes to restoring cars that you in-house, how do you balance, you know, making them factory fresh with still making some money on them? You know, there's got to be a line. You know, do you reach a standard and you think, right, let's stop there because there's still some money to be made in this?
Most of the time we're restoring cars on commissioned by the owner. And I think we've been through various waves where we were talking about this the other day, actually, at the showroom, where, of course, ideally you could buy your project car, you can restore it, and then at the end you've got a car that's worth, you know, A plus B equals C. And there was a period, perhaps with 3 litre CSLs, for example, which was the car we were talking about, where you could buy a reasonable project car, spend the money on, you know, parts availability, not having to have things made by hand, assemble the car, and it's kind of worth what you spent on it. I think we're back in, unfortunately, what I've seen over the last 2 or 3 years since Brexit, I think what's happened is the costs of restoring a car have soared much, much faster than the values of the cars again. So we're out of sync again. And if people want to restore a car properly, they have to spend way, way more than a sensible, but you know, you have to open your checkbook and basically be ready for whatever's coming. 9 times out of 10, you know, you start off with a reasonable idea of what you want to achieve, but you don't really know where it's going to end until you've taken it to bits, put it in boxes, labelled it all, and then put it all back together again.
Which presumably makes the concept of just going and spending 75 grand on a new M3 that works out of the box.
There is something to be. I mean, I know it's not how I own cars, but there is that thing, isn't it? That if you just buy something, you just pay you know how much you're paying every month. You don't necessarily own, in inverted commas, the car, but you don't own anything that goes wrong with it either. It's just, you know, I get why people.
And you can park it outside the station and not worry about.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not how I own a car, but I do understand why people.
I think they're really different concepts of car ownership. You know, at a fundamental level, what I see and what I'm seeing now, I'm seeing guys who perhaps were in their school years in that sort of purple patch of the 80s. You know, so I'm 51 coming up, and you know, I remember those fantastic cars that sort of were the birth of this culture we're talking about. You know, everything from Peugeot 205 GTIs and Renault 5 Turbos and all that era of cars that were suddenly sexy. And I see that age group of people now coming of age where they've got, you know, they've got their house, they've probably got a second house, and they've got some spare cash. And the excitement of them of taking a schoolboy dream and building it up from scratch completely to their design, so they can choose the colour of the paint, they can choose the interior, they can choose how the engine's tuned. We're doing an E30 M3 Europameister at the moment for a guy. And by and large, for example, he's sticking to factory spec, but then he's breathing on the engine. So he's basically trying to do a Sport Evo spec with, you know, carbon fibre air intake and all these kind of embellishments. And you can see that the more he's doing, the more he's getting really, really into this car that is a complete and utter one-off. And I think for him, I wouldn't be surprised if he's got a daily run around an X7 or something like that. You know, he's that type of guy, he's a professional guy. And then he's got something in his garage which is utterly unique that he's kind of had a massive part in putting together with us. You know, so it's got the Munich Legends sort of cachet with it. And I can really see the appeal in something that is completely unique. But you know, wherever you go, people are going to stop you and admire it. And it's just, you know, I get it. But they're two completely different experiences.
Do your technicians get as excited about the new stuff as the older stuff? Can they work on both?
Yeah, I think it's often different technicians that have different fortes and different, you know, different preferences. But I think there's enough going on at BMW that there's still plenty to get excited about. You know, even standard modern M2s. The M2 is a fantastic little machine. It's to me, it's the E46 M3 reborn. Even just the standard non-competition pack ones. They're just a wicked little car. You know, I think I'm a bit concerned that M cars don't have that individual hand-built feel, of course, that they used to have. But go back to the M6 Grand Coupe, it's a faultless machine, and it's very hard not to get excited about a thing like that.
Are you excited
about it? I still get those butterflies and that jittery feeling when you drive it. You know, I mean, that's all you're asking for, isn't it?
Are you excited about, well, inevitably, M cars will have to go electric. We've had a taster, haven't we? The
i4. Yeah, the
i4. M50. So, you know, in 10, 15 years, will they be on your forecourt?
I don't know. That's a big question being thrown around a lot at the moment. We had so for the Legends in the Fall evening, we had the usual displays of, you know, M1s, and you know, we're trying to do a 50 years of M kind of setup. But then we thought we'd throw a little curveball into the action. So on the actual forecourt, we put the G90 M5 next to the i4 M50. And of course, you've got a lot of people coming in and going, oh, electric cars, you know, and the usual thing. And you just, so we deliberately did say, okay, there's the keys, if you like, just go up and down the straight and come back and see what you think. And you know, it just blew everybody away. You can't not be blown away driving that i4 M50. So I got two heads here. I've got my commercial business head that's asking, you know, what the future looks like for Munich Legends. But as a car enthusiast, I think electric cars have got plenty to say. You know, there's plenty going on there. You know, I also love the idea of the silence of it all. I love brilliant sounding cars that, you know, wonderful V8s and beautiful exhaust notes and air intake and all the rest of it. But also love the idea, you know, the sort of sci-fi aspect of getting in a car that's phenomenally quick like that i4 M50, and also, you know, eerily quiet and a perfect machine, basically. So I can imagine an awful lot of people will be investing in a classic car to offset the boredom of having an electric car. And of course, if they're going to come to Munich Legends for one, they might as well come for the other. So I'm guessing that we'll have to do electric and be enthusiastic about it just as much as petrol.
Yeah. Do you get many Alpinas coming through?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, quite a few. Yeah, from all ages, actually, right across the spectrum. Although less modern ones, probably.
Yeah. And do they get a different kind of buyer, a different kind of enthusiast who likes that? I'm just thinking now BMW's taken Alpina in-house, whether actually electrification rather suits an Alpina with the hush and the sort of reservedness and everything else.
Well, there's two types of Alpina. Mm. Of course, there's the original stuff that they were turning out in the sort of mid-80s, which is everything but, you know, smooth and elegant and refined, which is what they later sort of picked up that type of client. But if you look at the E34, you know, the B10 bi-turbo, that's an absolute mad monster, you know, even more mad than the M5. So it's weird, you know, Alpina have metamorphosized over the years from, you know, pure race-bred, you know, nutcase cars right the way through to modern diesel tourings, which, you know, which in recent years is what they made all their money from. So I do see a different type of buyer. I think there's it's a very interesting question, because of course they're all under the BMW umbrella, but people who buy M cars are often really quite different in terms of what they're looking for from people that buy Alpinas. The problem with Alpinas is their residuals and, you know, the values. They, you know, I think people often buy them thinking they're rare, you know, unusual, very, very low numbers made, and therefore, you know, the values are going to be high and strong and reliable, and they're not, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, because I've sort of got this outside perspective. I've never driven an Alpina, so I've never really had it shown to me how different they are from an M car, but that contextualises it quite nicely. I think it used to be a bit of a hooligan brand, and now it's... Well, you spoke to the boss of Alpina, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple of months ago. Yeah, and they just, you know, they just said, you know, there are so many risks with, you know, because they have to take such a financial risk of how many of these cars are we going to make, and do enthusiasts really want an electric Alpina, given that they might drive on the autobahn at high speed from, you know, one German city to 300 miles to another, and then the Japanese still like diesels. They think about diesels as we did in 2005. You know, they like a high spec, high performance thing, and they're just like, you know, if we get it wrong, the risks are immense. And BMW came to them and said, well, why don't we have it? And they went, yeah, okay. So they'll do Alpina Classic, yeah, and still restore stuff and look after things. But it's an interesting... it's an interesting brand, I think. Dan, what's your... If you are dreaming up your ideal BMW/M/Alpina, what does it look like?
Well, it's interesting. I've got a bit of a bone to pick with the old Alpina because they don't look after their classic clients.
Oh, really?
I think, you know... Yeah, I mean, we've had some really difficult adventures with E12, for example, E12 B7S turbo, which I think might be the sexiest car I've ever seen, but they have real electronic problems. They have real issues, and Alpina don't want to help. And we've had cars that are basically, you've got a choice between either modifying it so it's no longer original and no longer a proper Alpina by effectively redoing the engine management system, or the car doesn't run ever again. So it's been a bit sad, really, because I've seen two. One was an E24 B7S turbo. One was an E12. And you look at those cars and think they are seriously special machines. But Alpina were just adamantly refused to help and refused to get involved in what we needed them to do. Mm. And they're difficult to get parts for. You know, I think that those early cars, those sort of 80s cars, were the sort of things that, you know, M kind of copied what Alpina were doing. Mm. You know, it's Alpina that were first putting completely mad engines into sensible-looking family saloons. Okay, they dressed them up. They were hardly sensible by the time Alpina had finished with them. But you know, that I think gave the impetus to M to develop things like the M5. And obviously, you know, since then they've never looked back. And it's weird that Alpina kind of kicked it all off, and then M took over, and Alpina ended up making, you know, cuddly diesel touring. Yeah. So, it's impossible for me to land down at one car, but I mean, I think classic wise, I think for me the 3 liter CSL has never been. It's never been better. BMW just produced the most elegant, lovely, beautiful driver's car, and you know, it's something I'd never sell. It's something I'll have until I die, I'm sure. So I'd probably pick a 3 liter CSL. I'd probably pick a V7S turbo, that E12, which was just amazing. And I think I'd probably just at the moment the mood takes me to say the Grand Coupe. But if you ask me again in a week, it'd be a completely different set of answers. <Yeah.
laughs> What about some of the smaller stuff? We talked about lots of the saloons and the SUVs, but I noticed on the site you've got a couple of sweet Z3Ms, which I quite saw one of them yesterday. And I thought, actually, that's a really nice looking car. Yeah, so, you know, is there a market for that still?
Yeah, the Z3Ms, I mean, they're wicked little things, really. They've been classic cars since they were new. I remember seeing them in the showrooms and just thinking, what on earth is that? You know, and it hasn't really changed. I think... I think, you know, they're a fascinating car because they put a spotlight on a period of time at BMW M where they could do stuff like work on a project in the evenings. I don't know how much of it's legend, but I think the story goes that this wasn't even approved by the board. It was just a bunch of blokes staying behind after work, souping up a car that wasn't particularly, you know, wasn't exactly the best-selling car in the range. And they thought, well, let's make an M car out of it, and we'll chuck a load of bits out of the parts bin on the car, and then we'll go and see the board when we kind of put a prototype together, and they said, yeah, go for it. So we made 1,000 of them or something, you know, and it's just that would never happen today, I don't think. But a company that size at that time that were that ambitious worldwide, that were still commissioning projects like that, I think was what made them such a fascinating company. I think that's the thing they've lost a little bit in their quest for global glory.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine a Z1 today, isn't it? Which are, what are they? What are they, I've never driven one, but what are they? What are they like?
Well, I have to be diplomatic in my answer.
That good.
They appeal to people because of their, you know, off the wall quirkiness. They're a bit underpowered. I mean, they did I think 8 Mosselman turbos, which are a bit more lively. But I think what people like about them, I think they're a very ownable classic car. You know, they don't rot. Mechanically, you know, they're built on a very, very reliable platform. You know, it's basically an E30, and the M20 engine is very, very robust. The Achilles heel is the fact, ironically, that they don't rust because they've got plastic panels. But unfortunately, most of the panels crack. And right. The way that they're actually fixed onto the car is... Do you remember they had this thing that you could change the colour and change the
body
panels?
Yeah.
Well, you can't.
No.
But it's a nice idea. Where the front wing's fixed to the car, there's, I think, 3 fixing points. And, of course, as the car flexes, being a convertible, it's flexing a lot. Mm. And as it flexes, it fissures the wing and usually through the fixing point. So it makes it unfixable. And then, of course, BMW decided not to produce any of the panels anymore. But apart from that, it's a very ownable car. It's really, really cheap to run, really cost-effective to own. And... wherever you go, you're going to have a conversation with people about it. Yeah. And I think the people that buy them are buying them because it's just something really different that you don't see, you know, don't see anywhere else. Even though they made thousands of them.
The biggest risk with a Z1 was always falling out halfway through a corner, wasn't it? The doors, if you'd forgot to put the doors up.
Or trying to get in it without losing your dignity. I mean, if you've ever tried to get into a Z1 with the roof up, even with the door down, it's just, there's actually, we've got one in the showroom at the moment, and... in amongst the paperwork was something that somebody's obviously saved out of a magazine and laminated. And it's like a step-by-step, maybe there's 12 photos of a lady trying to get into how to get into your Z1 and maintain your dignity. And basically, by the time you get to the end, you realise you can't.
That would explain why I can't remember the last time I saw one with a roof on. I've only ever seen one photograph
of
the dam.
Brilliant looking car.
I think it's one of those times where you make sure you're wearing matching underwear because you know if you're a lady because it's not the most elegant entry and exit.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I think we'll wrap it up there. It's been fantastic to hear from you. Great to get a little bit of insight. I think I'm going to spend probably the rest of the day on your website.
Yeah, the rest of the working day is ruined, isn't it? Thanks. Yeah, that's the last thing.
No, thank you for having me on. It's my first podcast. It's been fun.
Is it? It's been a great pleasure, Dan. Thanks so much. It won't be your last, I'm sure. Yeah,
no, we'll have to pop down as well, I think.
Thanks, everybody.
You'll be most welcome.
Yeah, thank you, mate. And thank you for listening to this AutoCar podcast. There are more of these on your favourite pod provider, and you can contact us about any of them at autocar@haymarket.com. We're at autocar.co.uk all the time, in newsagents every Wednesday, on digital subscription and on the YouTube as well. Like and subscribe. All right, thanks very much. See you next time.
Thank you. Goodbye.
As a major research institution, Arizona State University offers the most online bachelor's degree programs, along with world-class faculty and dedicated support. Discover why ASU is ranked number one in innovation for 9 consecutive years. Tap to learn more.